crippled the chains with which he was bound, until he could no longer breathe without our hearing them rattle. But to my astonishment, Lafleur coughed again to clear his throat, and, with a touch of pedantry, in a curiously gruff, affected voice, gave the following exposition. Master and slave exist in a necessary tension of a twinned actuality, which is transmuted only by the process of becoming. A sage of ancient China, they learned, Huang Zu, dreamed he was a butterfly. When he woke up, he was hard put to it, to tell whether a man had dreamed he was a butterfly, or a butterfly was still dreaming he was a man. If you looked at your situation objectively for a moment, my dear Count, you might find that the principal cause of your present discomfort is a version of Shuang Tzu's dilemma. You could effectively evolve a persona from your predicament if you tried. But the Count was incapable of the humility of objectivity, and took only a few hints to further his soliloquy from Lafleur. Am I the slave of my aspirations, or am I their master? All I know for certain is I aspire to a continuous sublimity, and my aspirations accentuate the abyss to which I have fallen. In the depths of this abyss, I find the black pimp. But Lafleur continued to expand his theme. You were a man in a cage with a monster, and you did not know if the monster was in your dream, or if you were the dream of the monster. The Count clanged his chains with dreadful fury. No! 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 But this triadic reiteration was addressed to the shadows, not to Lafleur, who commented with some asperity. Now you believe yourself to be the dream of the black pimp, I suppose. That is the reverse of the truth. But the Count did not hear him. I toppled off my pyrotechnic tiger, and as I plunged downwards, endlessly as Lucifer, I asked myself, what is the most miraculous event in the world? And I answer myself, I am going to fall into my own arms. They stretch out to me from the bottom of the pit. I am entirely alone. I and my shadow fill the universe. Lafleur gasped at that, and so did I, for I felt myself instantly negated. To my horror, I discovered I immediately grew thinner and less solid. I felt, how can I describe it, that the darkness which surrounded us was creeping in at every pore to obliterate me. I saw the white glimmer of Lafleur's face, and held out my hands to him imploringly, beseeching him to go with me together into the oblivion to which the Count had consigned us, so that I should have some company there in that cold night of non-being. But before my senses failed me, there was a sudden, dreadful clamor on deck. The accordion sputtered a final, distracted, terrified chord. There were screams, thuds, and an awful wailing suddenly cut short that the pig must have made when the pirates cut its throat, while a hundred tongues announced that chaos was come. Abruptly, I fell out of the magic circle of the Count's self-absorption. My dissolution was cut short. The end of our imprisonment had come. The ship had been attacked by pirates. They were swart, thick-set, yellowish men of low stature, equipped with immense swords and massive mustaches. They spoke a clicking, barking, impersonal language and never smiled, though, when they decapitated the crew in a lengthy ritual by the light of flares on the deck, they laughed to see the heads roll and bounce. Once they knew we were murderers, they treated us with respect, cut off our chains with swift blows of their heavy swords, which were of incredible sharpness, and let us up on deck to watch the debacle. No one was spared except ourselves. After all their heads were off, the torsos went into the sea, where the pirates set about improvising small fires to cure the heads, which they proposed to keep as souvenirs. The Count visibly grew fatter at the smell of blood. He watched the ghastly ballet of the execution with the relish of a customer at the cabaret. When he flung off his cloak and the pirates saw he still wore the uniform of the House of Anonymity in all its arrogant exoticism, they gasped with admiration and bowed deeply to him in a display of servility. Another reversal had re-established his continuity. He was in the ascendance again. But Lafleur lost all the crispness he had displayed in the cabin. He became wary and uneasy and stayed close beside me. Later I learned he was very much afraid and almost about to reveal himself, so that we might not die without knowing one another again, for the pirates were the mercenaries of death itself. They sailed these angry waters, far from the land that spawned them, in a black ship with eyes painted on the bows, and the stern fashioned into the shape of the tail of a black fish. The triangular sails were black, and they flew a black flag. They were some mixed tribe of Kurds, Mongols, or Malays, but the saturnine visages hinted at an infernal origin, and they worshipped a sword. As soon as the crew was dead, they set about stripping the cargo vessel and transferring its contents to their own boat. When they found the casks of rum in the forecastle, they greeted them with obscure grunts of glee, but they did not broach them immediately. Instead, they piled them as a votive offering around the altar of the sword they kept on the poop of the black sheep. Now Lafleur and I clung to the Count like scared children, for the pirates offered him instinctive reverence. When they saw our wrists were chafed from the manacles, they wrapped rags soaked in oil and spices around them, and gave us for nothing a far more spacious cabin than the one the Count had hired, a wide room with straw mats on the floor, mattresses for sleeping, and a tasteful watercolor of a black cockerel, a little sea-stained, hanging on the wall. They brought us satisfying and delicious meals of rice, curry fish, and pickles. The ship was frail and lightly built. I felt far closer to the sea than I had done before, and hence far nearer to death, for the slightest breeze could tip it over and fling us and our hosts into the sea. But they were the most expert sailors. During his adventures in the East, the Count had picked up a smattering of many tongues and found some words and phrases he could share with the pirate leader. So he spent most of his time with this brooding and diminutive killer, whose face was as unyieldingly severe as the object he worshipped, intent on learning some of their art of swordsmanship. He also learned our destination. We would cross the Atlantic in their mournful cockle shell, boarding whatever craft we passed, round the Cape of Good Hope, cross the Indian Ocean and any other ocean that lay in our path, and eventually drop anchor in an island off the coast of China, where they kept their booty, their temples, their forges, and their womenfolk. A long, weary journey full of dangers lay before us, and the landfall I was sure we would find replete with horrors. Now we were free. I was far more frightened than I had been in chains. The shrine on the deck consisted of a sword laid between two ebony rests. From a pole above it hung a number of garlands of heads, all smoked a dusky tan color, and shrunk to the size of heads of monkeys by the process of curing. Every morning, after prayers, The pirate leader removed the black loincloth, which was his only garb, and bent over on the poop in front of the altar while each of his men filed past him in devout silence, kissed his exposed arse, and emitted a sharp bark of adulation, while slapping his buttocks briefly with the flat of their blades. Their fidelity to their lord was so great, one could have thought each pirate was only an aspect of the leader, so that the many was the one. They were indistinguishable from one another. They were like those strings of paper figures, hand in identical hand, that children cut out of sheets of paper. After this display or refreshment of fidelity, they practiced with their swords. These were heavy, double-bladed shafts of steel, half the height of the pirates themselves, with handles constructed in such a way they had to be grasped with both hands. Though their use required great skill, it needed no finesse, for the most telling stroke was a murderous, chopping blow that easily split a man in half. It was impossible to fence with such a sword. It was equally impossible to defend oneself except by attacking first. They were weapons which denied forethought, impulses of destruction made of steel. And the pirates themselves, so slight, so silent, so cruel, so two-dimensional, seemed to have subsumed their beings to their swords, as if the weapons were their souls, or as if they had made a pact with their swords to express their spirit for them. For the flash of the sword seemed by far a more expressive language than the staccato monosyllables that came so grudgingly to their lips. Their exercises lasted for 6 hours a day. They transformed the decks into an arcade of flashing light, for the blades left gleaming tracks behind them that lingered in the air for a long time. After they finished, they polished their swords for another hour and, as the sun went down, joined together to sing a tuneless hymn, which might have been a requiem for the day they had killed with their swords. After that came a night of perfect silence. The pirates fed us and left us alone, for which I was heartily thankful. The ship was a black seabird, a marine raven. It skimmed over rather than cut through the waves, and though there was only this thinnest of matchwood skins between us all and death, the sheer virtuosity of their seamanship maintained us in a position something like that of a ship navigated along a tightrope. Their seamanship was as amazing as their swordsmanship, and, from the risks they took, seemed also to imply an intimate complicity with death. Lafleur and I, alone in our cabin, spent the days in quiet and foreboding. I discovered his hooded, luminous eyes watched me all the time with affection, even devotion. And I began to feel I had known him all my life, and he was my only friend. But you could not have said that this new warmth blossomed, for now he took on an almost Trappist speechlessness, and scarcely said more than good morning or good evening to me. I began to feel I would soon lose the use of my tongue. I counted the days by scratching a line with my fingernail on our cabin wall. And the 12th monotonous day, it was the full moon. And when they staved in the covers of the rum barrels, I realized they meant to release their pent-up inhibited passions in a debauch. They said about the initial processes of becoming drunk with the same glum diligence that characterized all their actions. It was a night of sweltering, ominous calm. A gibbous moon fired the phosphorescence in the waters, so that the black ship rocked on a bed of cold, scintillating flame, and they wreathed the sails so that the ship could look after itself for the rest of the night and most of the next day, if need be. for every single one proposed to drink himself to complete insensibility. Then they arranged themselves in ranks on the deck, cross-legged on round straw mats, as was their custom, facing the poop, while their leader sat facing them under the shrine with his guest, the count, beside him and the cask of rum before him. Each man held his canakin ready, and the leader, after barking a grace before drink, scooped out a ladleful of rum from the cask into the count's canakin and then helped himself. The pirates went up one by one for their shares. The outlines were as distinct as those of Indonesian shadow puppets. They each wore a black loincloth, and each carried at his side a sword in its scabbard. They twisted black sweatbands around their heads, and none of them was taller than 4¾ feet. Death's weird hobgoblins. As he took hold of his spilling portion, each pirate took off his sword and put it down on the growing pile beside the leader. Either in a gesture of trust, or as a hygienic precaution intended to forestall the ravages they might wreak with their weapons when they had drunk enough. As the crew passed up its cans for its rations, Lafleur, gazing beside me through the window, softly tugged my sleeve. "Look," he said, "there is land against the sky." Across the undulating plateau of bright water, far, far away, the shapes of a tropical forest flung up their fringed arms against the white sky. We had already traveled many hundreds of miles to the south. The distant landscape was as unfamiliar to me as that of another planet. And yet, it was land, and the sight of it chilled my heart, although I would be denied the comfort of it. "The currents around here are deceitful, and the tornadoes come swiftly, unheralded and treacherous," said Lafleur. "They have chosen a foolish time for a drinking bout. The demands of ritual are always stronger than those of reason," I replied. "When the full moon comes, they must get drunk, even in the teeth of a hurricane." "I wish they did not worship steel," he said. "Steel is so inflexible." It was delightful to talk to somebody again, and to feel his goodwill beside me. Although, again, his disguise was far too cunning and complete for me to penetrate. "Well, we can't persuade the hurricane to smash the ship and let us live through it," I said. "No, indeed," said Lafleur. "But the hurricane is governed only by chance. Chance, at least, is neutral. One can rely on the neutrality of chance. And when I look at the sky, I think I see a storm." I, too, looked at the sky, but saw only moonlight and the drifting banks of cloud. But as the pirates lined up for their second round, they were already grunting with savage mirth and poking one another, for they had only the most primitive idea of fun. Their behavior moved between only the two poles of melodrama and farce. As soon as they took off their frivolous armor, laid by their swords, and had a drop or two of rum inside them, they frolicked with the mindlessness, but not the innocence, of infants. Even from our cabin, I could see the count was growing disillusioned with them. He had admired the deathward turning darkness. Yet after the third round, they stripped off their loincloths, and one and all embarked on a farting contest. They made the radiant welkin ring with a battery of broken wind, exposing to the moon the twin hemispheres of their lemon-colored hinder cheeks. Each banged away as loudly as he was able, amid a great deal of unharmonious laughter, and soon they began to set light to the gases they expelled with matches, so a blue flame hovered briefly above every backside. "The clouds are piling up," said Lafleur breathlessly, and indeed the sky was glowing sullen, so that now the moonlight fell with a baleful glare the convives were too drunk to see. They fell to wrestling and horseplay, tripping one another over as they passed on an endless chain to receive the apparently inexhaustible rum, and their leader, who took two or three drinks for each one the man received, often missed the canakins altogether and upset the ladle on his creature's head. This convulsed them with laughter. Someone untied the trophies from the shrine, and they began to play a stumbling game of football with them. The count sat quite still above them, brooding above these broigle-like antics, his face set in lines of aristocratic distaste. "The moon has put on a halo," said Lafleur excitedly. When I looked up, I saw the angry moon was surrounded with a sulphurous aura, and from its white mouth now belched vile hot gusts. The pirates, however, were beyond knowing or caring. Some, as if felled, tumbled down where they stood and snored immediately. Others first puked weakly and staggered before they slumped to the deck, but most simply sank down and slept the deep sleep of the newly purified. The cries, laughter, and bursts of drunken song slowly faded away. Though he had absorbed most, the leader was the last to go. He slithered slowly from an upright position, clasped the rum tub to break his fall, and then he and the tub together rolled along the poop for a while and lay still in a pool of spilled liquor. The count rose up and seized the holy sword from its shrine with a gesture that implied that God was too good for them. He was as tall as a stork and as wild as the spirit of the storm, which now broke upon his in a sudden squall. Lightning danced along the blade, and the rain struck the oblivious revelers with tropic fury, while the count hissed, "Scum!" and spat upon the pirate leader. Stepping through the bodies in the puddles of vomit and excrement with fastidious distaste, he went to the stern of the ship and inexorably directed us into the eye of the whirlwind. We ran from the cabin to crouch at his side like his dogs for his protection. For now again we saw him in his tempestuous element. The tempest seemed his tool. He used this tool to destroy the black ship and its sailors. The very air turned to fire. The topmast and incandescent spoke snapped and crashed. Storm-borne luminescence danced upon every surface, and the rain and driving waves lashed us and soaked us until we were half drowned before we sank. Lafleur and I clung to one another while the ship tilted this way and that, tossing its freight of sleeping swine hither and thither, flinging them senseless into the boiling sea or crushing them beneath its disintegrating timbers. The black sails unfurled and flew away on the wings of the storm. He flourished the sword like a wand or a baton, for he conducted the tempest as though it was a symphony orchestra, and again we heard his disheveled laughter louder than the winds and waters put together. The currents and the wind were driving us nearer and nearer land in the random flares of the lightning. We saw the giant palms threshing and bowing double as if in homage to the count. Yet we could see nothing clearly, for our motion was too uncertain, and soon the ship broke up in a succession of shivering concussions, and all who sailed in it were flung into the water. Yet not a single one of the southern pirates flickered so much as an eyelid while the sea engorged them. And we, the living, were washed up on a white beach, which the wind molded into fresh dunes at every moment, together with a great quantity of black driftwood and yellow corpses. Yes, we were saved. Lafleur, the Count, and I. Although we were little more than skin swollen with salt water, and our ears were still as full of the hurricane as if shells were clapped to them, blotting out all other sounds. But the great grandfather of all breakers tossed me negligently on the spar to which I clung, almost to the margin of the forest. Lafleur followed me on a lesser wave, holding on to the rudder. I stumbled down the beach and dragged him up the sand, out of harm's way. And then a lightning flash showed me the Count walking out of the water as simply as if he had been bathing. In his eyes, a strange glow of satisfaction. And in his hand, still the mighty blade. We followed him a little way into the forest, and there Lafleur and I made ourselves a kind of nest in the undergrowth, and slept as soon as our battered heads touched the grassy pillow. But the Count sat up awake all night, keeping some kind of vigil with his sword. He was still kneeling among the brushwood when we woke. The playful monkeys were pelting us with leaves, twigs, and coconuts. The sun was high in the sky. The mysterious susurration of the tropical forest trembled sweetly in my ears after the clamor of the oceans. The air was soft and perfumed. The storm was over, and a miraculous peace filled the vaulted imperial groves of palms. A web of lianas let a translucent green light down upon us three ill-assorted babes in the wood. And it was already so hot that steam was rising in puffs from our drenched clothing, and the now filthy bandaging Lafleur obstinately refused to take off his face. It was marvelous to feel the solid ground beneath my feet again, even if I was not at all sure to which continent the ground belonged. I thought it must be my own far American South, but the Count opted hopefully for savage Africa, while Lafleur observed remotely that we had not the least notion where we really were, but had probably been blown willy-nilly onto the coast of some distant island. When we went down to the beach to wash ourselves, we soon saw the inhabitants were black, and so felt certain we were in Africa. The tide in receding had left corpses strewn with shells all along the endless white beach, and the glistening purity of the sand emphasized the surpassing ebony of the inhabitants, who, clad in long robes of colored cottons and necklaces of dried beans, diligently searched among the debris for its trove of swords. They were men and women of great size and dignity, accompanied by laughing children of extraordinary charm. And when they saw us, they lowed gently among themselves like a congregation of wise cattle. Our garments smoked. We stood still and allowed them to approach us. They did so slowly, some trailing the pirate swords unhandily behind them. Their faces and chests were whorled and cicatrized with tribal marks, knife cuts discolored because white clay had been rubbed into them. As we waited, more and more of them came out of the margin of the jungle, walking with such grace they might all have been carrying huge pots on their heads, where their naked children dance around them like marionettes carved out of coal. When he saw their color, the Count began to shiver, as if he had caught a fever in the sea. But I knew he shivered out of fear. But this solid, moving shadow showed no fear of us, though soon they formed a great ring about us, hemming us in on all sides, and we knew we had been captured. Then we heard the sound of crude but martial music, and a jaunty detachment of Amazons marched out of the forest. And these women were elderly and stereotopicus. They were the shapes of ripe pears bursting with juice, and their wrinkled dugs swung loosely back and forth, inside and outside the silver breastplates they wore. But all the same, they were a splendid sight. Some with scarlet cloaks and loose white breeches made of swathes of cloth tucked up between the legs. Others with cloaks of chocolate brown and dark blue breeches, all with metal helmets crowned with decorations of black horsehair. Their officers chosen, it would seem, as much for the size of their bottoms as anything, march beside them playing long-stemmed brass trumpets and little hand drums. And these female soldiers were aggressively armed with duck guns, blunderbusses, muskets, and razor-like knives, a museum of ancient weapons. They easily made us understand by signs we were under arrest again, and took us heavily, if quaintly guarded, down the green path to a clearing where their village lay, where the black host fell in behind us with the same decorum that marked all they did. The village was a seemly place of roomy huts made of dried mud, and we were taken into a neat, clean house and offered a breakfast of some kind of pounded grain mixed with a minced pork, served on fronds of palm. Lafleur and I ate heartily, but the Count, unmanned again, a quaking skeleton, ate nothing. He cowered deep under the quilts they had given us to rest on, repeating over and over again, "Nemesis comes." But they were far too polite to even raise their eyebrows when they saw him. Indeed, the only discordant notes in all this sober, harmonious decency were the low stools on which we were invited to sit and the low tables off which we ate, for they were ingeniously fashioned out of bones which, from their shapes, could only have been human. But these bones were dressed up so prettily that at first one hardly realized they were bones at all. For they had been painted dark red and then adorned with tessellations of gummed shells and feathers. They took away our ragged, filthy clothes with polite exclamations of distaste. Lafleur hid himself in a corner with a touching virginal modesty, until they brought us some of their lengths of cotton printed in blacks, indigos, and crimsons, so that we could cover ourselves. We made ourselves togas after the Roman fashion, and then Lafleur and I sat at the door of our hut in the sunshine, trying to chat wordlessly with the little children who stared at us with huge, solemn eyes. The children fingered Lafleur's bandages curiously because they thought the covering was a kind of upper face, and they laughed, and he laughed with them with such affecting motherliness, I ought to have suspected. But I suspected nothing. Shape-shifting was so much hocus-pocus to me. So, the morning whiled away peacefully enough, with never a hint of dread, though we saw the women were busily tending huge cauldrons which hung over fires in the open air, and, when the sun stood directly overhead, the captain of the female soldiers came to us and informed us that we must now go and pay our respects to the village chief, whose grand ceremonial cave lay a little way out of the village. So we straightened our togas and combed our fingers through our hairs. But the Count would not come of his own free will, so the captain had to poke him with the butt of a musket until he crept reluctantly out to join us. Oh, what a bedraggled demiurge he was. His black tights were all tattered and torn, so a fringe of tow peeped out at the foot of each, and his prick hung out of the aperture as limp and woe-begotten as a deflated balloon. He limped like an eagle with a broken wing. Poor Yellow Tiger. And yet he had ridden out his tempest in triumph the previous night, and even as we walked through the village, he took on, as if he summed up all his flagging courage to do so, a few shreds of enigmatic charisma, enough to fling back his head proudly, as if perhaps invigorated by the high brazen clamor of the trumpets which accompanied us. The path climbed steeply through the vaulted architraves of the palms, which sprang straight up to the sky in soaring, prodigious, bluish-grayish columns toward the tasseled parasols of emerald feathers which formed the capitals of this vegetable cathedral. A muted solemnity governed the tread of our guards. They changed their music to a more mournful key, and played what was almost a lament, and when we came to a waterfall, everyone fell on their faces to worship it. Beyond this waterfall was a cave in a rock face, with its entrance curtained in the printed cotton that covered us. The soldiers prostrated themselves again, so we knew this was where the chief lived, and also that his people held him in religious awe. The count had turned pale as if all the blood had been drained from his body, but still he held his ground with something of his old defiant spirit. The brass and the kettle drums fell silent, but we could hear the liquid music of the waterfall and the crackling of the wood that burned under a great pot outside the cave. When I looked behind me, I saw the entire village had followed us, and in the arborescent silence, we were the only men left standing up, for everyone else crouched with their faces deep in grass or flat on earth. The presence of 100 silent people filled the green twilight with a sacral quietude that made me uneasy. And then a sensuous parade of the chief's wives and concubines came from the cave without drawing the curtains apart so we could not see what lay beyond them. Intensely black and perfectly naked, these women wore plumes of ostrich in their hair and arranged themselves around the entrance to the cave in a frame of submissive adoration. Many bore the bleeding marks of gigantic bites in their breasts and buttocks. Some had a nipple missing. Most were minus one or several toes and fingers. One girl had a ruby set in the socket in place of a lost eyeball, and some wore false teeth carved in strange shapes out of the tusks of elephants. Yet all had been beautiful, and their various disfigurements lent them an exquisite pathos. After them came a number of eunuchs, and then the royal castrator, the royal barber, and several other barbarous officials, until the whole court was displayed before us, lined up before the cave as if they were posing for a group photograph. The drums now began to play again, a dismal throbbing like the palpitation of a dying heart. The tribe lay still on their faces, but two of the royal wives crawled forward, and at last drew back the curtains as the drums rolled and the trumpets suddenly whined, and we saw him, the chief. He sat on a throne of bones, on a dais of bones, which, as we watched, rolled ponderously forward on four wheels made of skulls, wheels that crushed the hands of half a dozen concubines before it came to a halt. Seated, he was 6.5 feet high. He was far, far blacker than the blackest night. He was a very sacred and very monstrous idol. On his head he wore a ceremonial wig consisting of 3 thick fringes arranged in concentric rings. That next to the skin of his head was brown, the middle one was crimson, and the outside fringe was of bright gold, like a diadem. Through this arresting chevelure was wound a chain of mixed carbuncles, and round his neck, virtually clothing the upper part of his body, were a great many gold chains with pendants, charms, and skulls of babies dangling from them. His face was brilliantly painted with 4 discs on either cheek, each one rimmed with white and colored inside yellow, green, blue, and red. A brown, white-rimmed eye was painted on his forehead between and above his own eyes. He carried the thigh bone of a giant for a scepter, painted scarlet and once again decorated with inlay and feathers. He wore the pelt of a tiger wrapped around his middle, and the root-like toes, which protruded from his sandals, were stuck with rings containing gems of amazing size and peerless water, as were his hands, which were so heavily beringed they looked as if they were mailed with jewels. His appalling face suggested more than Aztec horrors. And now the curtain was open. I could see that the cave behind him was an arcade of human skeletons. "Welcome to the regions of the noble children of the sun," he said in a cavernous voice that sank into thrilling depths, while the drums pounded on and on. But he did not speak to Lafleur and me. He addressed himself only to the Count. "You are my only destination," replied the Count. "You altered my compass so that it would point only to you, my hypocritical shadow, my double, my brother." Then I saw this dreadful chieftain was indeed the Black Pimp, who was now about to avenge his lover's murder. For such was the Count's desire, he should be and do so. The chieftain rose from his throne, stepped from his dais onto a footstool of groveling concubines, and took the Count into the warmest, most passionate embrace. But he concluded it by striking the Count such a heavy blow that he reeled out of the great black arms and fell to the ground. The chief set one foot on the Count's chest in an attitude of a successful hunter and spoke, it seemed, to the sky above us, which showed in patches of azure electricity through the vivid fronds of the palms. "The customs of my country are as barbarous as the propriety with which they are executed. For example, not one of those delightful children who seem each one to have stepped straight off the pen of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, but has not. Since he put forth his first milk teeth, dined daily off a grilled rump or roasted shoulder, a stew or fricassee, or else a hash of human meat. To this usually most abhorrent of comestibles, they owe the brightness of their eyes, the strength of their limbs, and the marvelous gloss of health in their skins, their longevity and their virility as great as it is discreetly practiced. Since this diet is certain to triple the libidinal capacities, as my wives and concubines can willingly testify. But we have learned to let circumspection sharpen our pleasures, and we conduct the most loathsome profligacy with no public show of indecency at all. How do I rule my little kingdom? With absolute severity. Only if a king is ruthless, only if he hardens his heart to the temper of the most intransigent metal, will he maintain his rule. I am a ruler both secular and divine. I hedge about my whims, which I firm my laws, with an awesome incomprehensibility of superstitious fears. The least rebellious thought rising weed-like in my subjects' hearts is instantly transmitted to me by my espionage system of telepaths, whose minds are magic mirrors and reflect not only faces but thoughts. Those incipient rebels and their entire families are condemned for the most fleeting wish alone, for we do not give them time to act. They are forthwith shipped directly to the army catering staff and boiled down to the nourishing soups which contribute towards the excellent, indeed, prolific physique of my army. While my punishments extend even towards that insubstantial part of themselves, their souls, for I encourage a belief in the soul in order to terrify them better. The least rebellious inclination, rising weed-like, condemns the subject and his seed to damnation for 3 generations. So it behooves them to tend their gardens well, and only let the lilies of obedience grow there. The Count now rose painfully to his feet, but the chieftain instantly kicked him back into a kneeling position, and the Count knelt at his feet for the rest of the interview. Why, you may ask, have I built my army out of women, since they are often held to be the gentler sex? Gentlemen, if you rid your hearts of prejudice and examine the basis of the traditional notions of the figure of the female, you will find you have founded them all on the remotest figure you thought you glimpsed once in your earliest childhood, bending over you with an offering of warm, sugared milk, crooning a soft lullaby, while, by her haloed presence, she kept away the snakes that writhed beneath the bed. Tear this notion of your mother from your hearts. Vengeful as nature herself, she loves her children only to devour them better, and if she herself rips her own veils of self-deceit, mother perceives in herself untold abysses of cruelty as subtle as it is refined. Not one of my Callipygian soldiery but has not earned her rank by devouring alive, first gnawing limb from limb and sucking the marrow from its bones, her firstborn child. So she earns her colors. To a woman, they are absolutely ruthless. They have passed far beyond all human feeling. The army, as one woman, lifted its head and smiled to hear this tribute, so I guess they were still capable of responding to flattery. And since my early researches soon showed me that the extent of a woman's feelings was directly related to her capacity for feeling during the sexual act, I and my surgeons take the precaution of brutally excising the clitoris of every girl child born to the tribe as soon as she reaches puberty, and also those of my wives and concubines who have been brought from other tribes where this practice is not observed. Therefore, I am proud to say that not a single one of my harem, or indeed any of the tribe of more than the Roman mothers you see before you, has ever experienced the most fleeting ecstasy, or even the slightest pleasure, while in my arms or in the arms of any of my subjects. So our women folk are entirely cold and respond only to cruelty and abuse. At that there was a rumbling murmur of approbation from all the men, and many broke into a spontaneous applause. The soldiers jumped at once and ran among the ranks of the tribe, beating them with the flats of their swords until they were quiet. In these regions you may observe man, in his constitutionally vicious, instinctively evil and studiously ferocious form. In a word, in the closest possible harmony with the natural world, I am in my hard-hearted way, most passionately in love with harmony. As an emblem of harmony, I would take the storm that rent your ship last night, resolving that poignant little fabrication of the human hand to constituents in harmony with this world, as it would be without man. That is natural. I would take the lion rending the lamb as an emblem. In a word, I would take all images of apparent destruction, and mark how I use the word apparent. For, in essence, nothing can be created or destroyed. My notion of harmony, then, is a perpetual convulsive stasis. I am happy only in that I am a monster. Now, when I thought about it, I knew that this man-eating hierophant, who recounted his proclivities to us with such pompous arrogance, could not possibly be the Black Pimp of New Orleans. He was only his living image. But the Count identified him rightly, in that his princeling of the Anthropophagi was yet another demiurge, and the Lithuanian aristocrat and the savage were twinned in that both were stormtroopers of the world itself. The world that is of earthquake and cataclysm, cyclone and devastation. The violent matrix, the real world of unmasterable physical stress, that is entirely inimical to man because of its indifference. Ocean, forest, mountain weather, these are the inflexible institutions of that world of unquestionable reality, which is so far removed from the social institutions which make up our own world, that we men must always, whatever our difference, conspire to ignore them. For otherwise, we would be forced to acknowledge our incomparable insignificance, and the insignificance of those desires that might be the pyrotechnic tigers of our world. And yet, under the cold moon and the frigid round dance of the unspeakably alien planets, are nothing but toy animals cut from colored paper. All this ran through my mind as the monster harangued the Count, and Lafleur's little hand reached out and grasped hold of mine for comfort. Nothing in our traditions suggests history. I have been very careful to suppress history, for my subjects might learn lessons from the death of kings. I burned all their former idols as soon as I came to power, and instituted a comprehensive monotheism, with myself as its object. I allowed the past to exist as a series of rituals concerning the nature of my omnipotent godhead. I am a lesson, a model, the perfect type of king and of government. I am far more than the sum of my parts. And now he smiled gently at the Count, and to my amazement, I saw that he reflected the Count's face perfectly, as if his own face were only a pool of dark water, and the paintings upon it a few blossoms floating on the surface. In a certain brothel in the city of New Orleans, once, I saw you strangle a prostitute solely to augment your own erotic ecstasy, my dear Count. Since that time, I have pursued you diligently across space and time. You excited my curiosity. It seemed I might be able to crown my own atrocities by making my brother in atrocity my victim. Thought I might, as it were, immolate myself to see how I should bear it. I wish you understand, to see how I would suffer. I have a great deal of empirical curiosity. A Jesuit in his black cassock once came to my tribe and lived among us for a year. When he learned my manners, he rebuked me so sternly, in the name of pity, that first I had him crucified, for he professed to admire so much this form of torture. And while he was still quivering on the tree, I cut out his heart with my own hands to see if such a professedly compassionate an organ had a different structure from the common kind of heart. But no, it did not. Now, I should like to see if we have a heart at all, dear Count. Are we ourselves so much the physical slaves of nature? And I wish to see if I can suffer like any other man. And then I want to learn the savor of my flesh. I wish to taste myself, for you must know I am a great gourmet. Bind him! Two female officers pounced on the Count and tied his wrists together with cords. From the ranks of the chief's retinue, a plump, giggling being wearing only a white chef's cap and a girdle hung with ladles stepped forward with a jar of salt in one hand and a nosegay of pot herbs in the other. He lavishly seasoned the water that now bubbled in the cauldron, where the Count began to laugh softly. "Don't you think I'm too old and tough and starveling to make a savory dish?"
"I thought of that," said the cannibal. "That is why I'm going to boil you up for soup."
The soldiers slit the Count's tights with the points of their swords, so they fell like opening petals from his white, scrawny legs. They slit his waistcoat and it fell. Naked, his tall, skeletal form and great mane of iron-gray hair was still clothed in that strange, intangible cloak of exalted loneliness. He was a king whose pride was all the greater because he lacked a country. The chef flung a string of onions into the pot, thoughtfully stirred in more salt, stirred and sipped the stock from his ladle. He nodded. The lady soldiers marched the Count between them to the fire, took firm hold each one of an elbow, lifted him bodily and plunged him feet first into the water, so that his head stuck over the rim. But his face did not change expression as it began to grow rosy, and he endured in perfect silence for far longer than I would have thought possible. And then, when he was red as a lobster, he began to laugh with joy, pure joy. "La Fleur," he called from the pot. "La Fleur, I am in pain. I've learned to name my pain, La Fleur!" And using the very last of his strength, he rose up out of the cauldron in an upward, surging leap, as of a fully liberated man. But when he reached his apex, his heart must have burst, for his mouth sagged, his eyes started, blood leaked out of his nostrils, and he fell back with a splash that scalded half the court with broth. This time his head disappeared entirely beneath the rim of the stew pot, and presently a delicious steam began to drift from the simmering concoction, so that the entire audience licked its lips in unison. At that, the chef clapped a lid on him. I was touched to see Lafleur's bandages were soaking up a trickle of tears, but then I realized he and I were also to feature as entremets for the ensuing feast. The chef ordered a team of apprentices to prepare long beds of glowing charcoal, and himself busily began to grease a gridiron.
"Skin the smallest rabbit first," commanded the chieftain, negligently.
And he did not bother to season us first with verbiage, since we were only so much meat to him. Two privates seized Lafleur's shoulders and dragged him away from me. They cut off his robe, although he struggled, and I saw not the lean torso of a boy, but the gleaming, curvilinear magnificence of a golden woman, whose flesh seemed composed of the sunlight that touched it far more kindly than the black hands of the fiendish infantry did. I recognized her even before they sheared away the bandages and showed no noseless, ulcerated, disfigured face, but the face of Albertina herself. Never before in all my life had I performed a heroic action. I acted instantly, without thought. I grasped the knife of one of my own guards and the musket of the other. I stabbed them both in their bellies, and then I stabbed the women who were preparing her for the pot. I flung away my knife and embraced her with one arm, while with the other I pointed the musket at the chieftain's head and pulled the trigger. The antique bullet, larger than a grape, pierced the painted eye in the center of his forehead. A great spurt of blood sprang out as from an unstoppered tap in such a great arc that it drenched us. He must have died instantaneously, but some spasm of muscle jerked him to his feet. The juggernaut rose up on his car.